Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Thank you very much for joining us. Before we get started on this week's podcast, a really exciting announcement. Peter Hart's book, The Gallipoli Evacuation, is now available to pre-order on our website. That's right, pre-order the book. It'll be out in September, but get your hands on a copy early because anyone who pre-orders the book will also receive an exclusive behind-the-scenes interview with Peter Hart that includes wonderful audio from Gallipoli veterans telling their story in their own words. It's absolutely extraordinary. In many ways, it's even more exciting than the book, but the book's pretty good too. So get your hands on the book, pre-order it now on our website, and get that exclusive interview that you can download straight away, and then you'll get the book when it comes out in September. So Peter Hart's The Gallipoli Evacuation, now available on the Living History website, which is livinghistorytv.com. That website again, livinghistorytv.com. Get your hands on the book. It's going to be something really special.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and thank you for joining us on Living History. This week, a topic that I think a lot of us are going to be fascinated to hear about. We are going to talk about animals during the First World War. Now, something that potentially gets a little bit overlooked, but obviously, particularly during the First World War, the involvement of animals was absolutely essential. So I'm really looking forward to hearing more about this. And to join us to talk about this, it's Michael Tyquin. So Michael, thank you very much for coming on the program.
Pleasure, Matt.
Now, as I said at the top of the interview, it's something that potentially gets a little bit overlooked, but animals were absolutely essential to the way the First World War was conducted, weren't they?
Very much so, and not only the First War and military, but civilian society at the time across Europe and indeed everywhere else, including Australia. It's very, very hard, I think, for people nowadays to understand just how central animals were in day-to-day life, say in Australia. And I'm talking mainly about horses, but we'll digress as we come into the war. So horses were everything. They pulled plows, they delivered bread and meat, and they pulled ambulances and trams and so forth. So they were quite a central part of early 20th century living in most countries.
When war broke out, were the nations that were involved in that war, were they prepared as far as animals were concerned? Did they have horses and did they have messenger dogs and all the animals that were eventually participating in that war? Was that ready to go at the outbreak of war, or was it something that they developed during the course of the conflict?
No, I think most nations were rather unprepared. And if we look at Germany, which is odd given that it I suppose you could argue with Austria and Hungary, started the war. In 1914, the Wilhelmine Army would require, say, an estimated 600,000 horses on mobilization. And that number exceeded its peacetime military requirement by almost 500,000 horses. So, you know, in August 1914, they had a big task ahead of them. Where were they to get these animals from? And the common challenge across all the belligerent countries were, if you pulled horses from civilian occupations, that meant harvests couldn't be brought in. That meant ramifications for food and other supplies. So I think your listeners will understand readily that pulling horses from one sector into a military sphere was fraught with peril.
Just talk to us a little bit. When we say animals, we mean more than just horses, don't we? What were the roles of animals across the board during the wartime?
Well, 1914, there were very few vehicles in any of the armies. For example, the Australian Army in early 1914 only had two motor vehicles. So horses particularly, but quite early in 1915, as we will see in Anzac and the Western Front, we look at mules and donkeys, and then with specific application to military purposes, we look at dogs and pigeons, in both cases for communications. But generally, the bulk of animals that we're talking about are horses and mules. They took the brunt of the war.
Prior to the First World War, we'd been through the Boer War. Did the Boer War teach lessons which would then be applied during the First World War?
It did, Matt, and fortunately, I think most countries learned, particularly Australia, with reference to quarantine, and we'll come back to that perhaps later in the interview. But some of the key lessons that were learned in the Boer War were the importance of good horse breeding, and you know, people talk about the light horse and the bush ethos and so forth. But in the two decades prior to 1914, horse breeding in Australia was not particularly well regarded. And the best horses that we did breed were all exported to overseas military buyers, particularly Japan and Germany. The other lessons that were learned in the Boer War were the importance of horsemanship, in other words, how to look after your horse. And this created issues with the British Army, because most reinforcements were infantry that were then rebadged as mounted infantry or yeomanry, and they had absolutely no idea how to care for horses. And we'll come back to this later when we talk about the Western Front. Acclimatization was the other key lesson, and the importance of not just releasing all the horses back to your own country once a particular campaign or conflict was finished, because in that case you're importing diseases and other issues. So they were important lessons from the Boer War. And, of course, Australian horse losses in that conflict totaled about 25,000 animals, so that was not a small number. So that works out to a casualty rate or a morbidity rate of about 70%. But the overall British loss in that campaign was staggering. It was over 320,000 horses. And it was, the Boer War was long regarded from a British point of view as just a disaster. But we'll get off this and we'll look at now World War One, if you like.
Well, the thing that fascinates me when we talk about something like horses, animals in general during wartime, is perhaps even more so than mechanized vehicles. They don't look after themselves. They need food. They need veterinary care. You know, they need places to sleep. They need places to rest. How were these animals and these groups of animals incorporated into the army, and how were they looked after?
Well, all armies at the time had an allocated number of horses. So, for example, a typical infantry division, if we're talking about Australia, would have about 5,000 horses. And these would be used for officers' mounts, for pulling general service wagons, for pulling other bits and pieces. And, of course, the artillery absolutely relied on horses completely in the early years of the First World War, right through to arguably 1918. So to manage the horse stock, you had to have a group of professional people to look after them. So we have the medical corps to look after soldiers, and for animals, we have the various veterinary corps. And all the belligerent armies in 1914 had a fairly well-established veterinary corps, although in Australia it was still new. We only deployed about 100 officers and other ranks to the war in 1914. But not everybody was in the same boat. Later, when the United States joined the First War in the Western Front, they did not deploy any formed veterinary units and lost a staggering number of horses in the first few months they were there. So the veterinary corps of the various countries were particularly important. And of course, doctrinally, the Australian veterinary corps was mirrored on that of the British Army, and the two worked very much hand in hand as the war progressed, as did the medical corps.
Men who served in the veterinary corps, where were they being sourced from? Were these people that had generally worked with livestock prior to the war, or were men being trained up as the war went along?
No, a bit like the light horse, Matt. When we talk about, you know, light horse, we think bushmen and so forth, but that's not the case. Many of the veterinary corps people were had a non-rural background, apart from the professional university graduates who composed the veterinary officers. A lot of the other ranks were drawn from urban backgrounds, and we're talking about farriers, horseshoers, and other animal carers who had to be trained. And fortunately, in the few months before deploying in 1914, particularly when we're looking at shaking out the first AIF, the members of the veterinary corps had ample opportunities to learn on the job, as it were, with shoeing and clipping horses and all sorts of things to prepare the first AIF to deploy to well, Europe, but as we know, ended up in Egypt.
Anyone who's spent any time working around farm animals in particular knows that they're quite high maintenance. They eat a lot of food, they need water, they need shelter. Talk to me about logistics involved with animals, particularly horses and mules, during the First World War, because the thing that always strikes me is to bring up the food required to feed a large number of horses, you need a lot of horses to bring up that food. There's a great irony in the logistical requirements to keep animals fed and watered, particularly on a battlefield, is quite extraordinary. Talk to me about logistics that were involved in having just so many horses and other animals on the battlefield.
Yes, you're quite right, Matt. Horses and other animals often ate their own weight in forage before they actually did any work. So this was always a huge issue. So forage, feed, and water were the two big challenges for those looking after animals, both on the Western Front and, as you can imagine, in the Middle East. So if we're looking at the campaigns in Palestine and Syria, where camels were the new beast to be added to the army stock of animals to be catered for. Now, the forage or the food was a big issue for all armies throughout the war, but particularly for Germany and Austria-Hungary. As the war drew on, the forage issue became a colossal problem. And we know in the Middle East that lack of good food really brought the Ottoman camel logistics system to a crashing halt. So again, you could argue perhaps, certainly in the Middle East, that had it not been for issues of forage and their own logistics, that the Ottoman response to Australian incursions would have been a bit more robust and lasted for longer. So you could imagine in the desert areas, bringing water to animals was an issue. And you might remember that General Maxwell in the Middle East actually pushed a railway line out close on the heels of his advance to Damascus, simply to supply water. On the Western Front, food was a constant issue, and most horses throughout most of 1916, 1918 were probably undernourished. And the same applied to men, of course. The conditions on the front just didn't allow delivery of food and water when they were required.
It's not just horses, as we mentioned before. There were messenger pigeons, there were messenger dogs. What other animals would you likely to see on a battlefield during wartime?
Well, mainly mules would be the biggest, I suppose, grouping of animals you would see in a battle area. They were used extensively both in the Middle East, Gallipoli, for example. Both the Indian Transport Corps and the Zion Mule Corps deployed with mules. And General Birdwood also had purchased almost 1,000 mules just for carrying water on Gallipoli. But as you know, Matt, apart from Suvla and in the north and Halys in the south, the area and the terrain around Anzac just precluded any wheeled transport. So apart from mules, there were no horses used in that campaign in that particular area. But on the Western Front, mules were really the backbone of the logistics chain. They did a great deal. And Australian soldiers were very high in their praise of mules. You know, they were hardy. They pulled more than their weight, as it were. And they didn't require quite the same element of care that perhaps a horse would.
When we talk about animals on the front line, obviously those animals are going to be exposed to the same dangers as the humans that are around them. How were animals treated in the event that they got sick, that they got wounded? What sort of care was available for animals in the front line?
Well, let's just talk very, very quickly about mechanisms of wounding, and these were certainly on the Western Front the same problems that faced the soldiers: the artillery, shrapnel, and later in the war from aerial bombardment, and gas. And these were all issues that affected animals to a larger or lesser extent. And then later in the war, from say late 1917 on the Western Front, as the Germans started, or from 1918 when the Germans started their retreat westwards or eastwards rather, they started to deploy what were called caltrops, which were a sort of a metal spike. And these were strewn across the battleground, and animals trod on them, and of course crippled a lot of animals. So to deal with wounds, and we'll talk about disease perhaps later, required a fairly sophisticated evacuation system. And the veterinary evacuation system almost mirrored the military medical system, whereby an animal was treated at the front, and if it was able to, it was left there and it would carry on. If not, it was evacuated rearwards through a fairly sophisticated system back to animal hospitals further back in the rear in France and even in Britain. And to do that, various means were used. There were horse ambulances, horse-drawn horse ambulances. Barges were used very effectively in France. And the railway, of course, we used to get sick animals back and then treated and then forwarded back to the front where they were required. All of these, as you can imagine, required a lot of people. The veterinary hospitals in the rear were very, very large establishments. The one and only Australian hospital was established just west of Calais. It could cater for about 2,500 animals, and its personnel numbered about 500 soldiers. So these were big, big units we're talking about. So generally, the evacuation system worked well, bearing in mind, of course, that if there was an artillery barrage or gas or anything, an attack on at the time, then obviously it all came to a screeching halt.
I've been doing work with Peter Hart on his new Gallipoli book about the Gallipoli evacuation. Yes. And one of the most moving parts of that whole story was trying to get the animals off, trying to get the horses and mules away from Gallipoli. And sadly, the ones that couldn't be taken off had to be shot on the beaches when they left them. And it was obviously a great source of distress for the men who'd spent so much time with these animals. Have you come across that in your studies? Have you come across a feeling of a bond between the men and these animals? Or did they simply see them as tools to help them win the war?
No, I have, Matt. That's a very valid point to make. And certainly in the Middle East, at the end of the war, a lot of light horse diggers, if you read their letters and diaries, were very, very moved when their mount had to be destroyed. And a lot of the diggers actually shot their own horses rather than have them, you know, seen herded off to some other place and shot or killed en masse, as it were. But that said, also letters and diaries reveal a similar affection between, or a bond between, the soldier and an animal with a camel and a mule. We all know the famous story of, you know, Simpson's donkey, which, as it turns out, was actually taken over by an Indian group and was taken to the island of Mudros, after which he seems to have been lost to history. But yes, a lot of soldiers were close to their animals, but not just horses.
Well, talk to me about some of those other animals. We touched on it earlier, but apart from just horses, I mean, I love the stories as well about, there was a famous story in 1917 about the Australians capturing a pillbox during an attack in the Ypres Salient. And while they were there, a messenger dog, a German messenger dog, arrived with an order to hold out to the last against the Australians. And by that time, they'd already taken the pillbox, and they adopted the dog as a mascot. What other animals were on the battlefield? And tell us about some of the relationships between the soldiers and those animals.
Well, messenger dogs were used by all sides and were quite effective and took a lot of care too. But they generally had their own carers, as we still do now with dogs in the army, and their bond was very, very close. And you often see them portrayed in old photographs of the time. Perhaps some of them I've actually seen wearing a little tin hat and so forth. They had a harness or some webbing which you would put your message in, or sometimes even something that was in short supply, perhaps some medical drugs and so forth, and they would be sent back to the front. And they were, you know, pretty successful. But like all other animals, they were prone to being gassed, which caused terrible injuries to the dogs. And pigeons too were the other key communications tool when the lines went down, and radio, as you know, were still quite primitive at the time. And pigeons too took a lot of care, and we know that there are a lot of mobile pigeon lofts deployed to the front, and you can see photographs of them, these pulled around by a vehicle or a horse, and you'd see all these little cages with pigeons in them. And these too had their own carers, and they had to be looked after, fed and so forth, and occasionally required veterinary treatment.
How many numbers are we talking here? Maybe we should just focus on Australia since we're an Australian program, but how many horses did Australia send overseas, and how many came back after the war?
Well, Australia exported just under 170,000 horses from Australia. Mules were basically bought in theatre, and most of those were imported from the Argentine, and they were quite a large sort of a beast. But as we know, only one horse was returned to Australia, and that was the lesson learnt from the Boer War. And the horse, of course, was General Bridges' mount, Sandy, and he was the only one to come back. The reason why so many horses were destroyed, both in France and in the Middle East, was the fear that these animals would bring back various diseases, particularly glanders, which would have just decimated the domestic Australian livestock industry. I think about, somehow they got through the system, but about 60 horses went back to Canada and caused absolute havoc. So Australia made the right decision. It was a tough one to take, but that explains why only one animal came back to Australia after the war.
General Bridges was, of course, killed at Gallipoli, and it was quite symbolic, wasn't it, that his horse was brought back to Australia after his death?
Absolutely, yes. He was shot by a sniper, I think, in May, from memory, very early on in the war in 1915.
As you've been talking about this, Michael, it makes me realise that the animals were exposed to the same horrors of the battlefields as the humans were, but the animals didn't really have a choice or an ability to understand what was going on. And it leads to the modern way that we remember animals now, particularly in times of war, that animals that serve in the military today receive medals just like their human counterparts. We've seen on the Western Front and in London, we've seen memorials to animals going up. Where do you stand in this whole philosophical concept about the poor, dumb animals that were sent off against their will or without the ability to understand, and the way we as humans then choose to memorialize them after the fact?
Oh, well, you raised two really complex philosophical arguments. There's the question of memory, and there's the question of, you know, how sentient are animals. As much as possible, animals were cared for pretty well in World War One. I mean, you know, looking at on the transport ships going from Australia to the Middle East, every care was taken with the horses. They were well fed, they were well looked after. Where possible, preventative measures were used in the Middle East, for example, special tarpaulins and bamboo posts were deployed to provide shade in really hot areas. And on the Western Front, we had anti-bomb earthworks designed specifically for horse lines to help prevent shrapnel injuries. And also we had, although not with the same success, what were called horse respirators, the equine equivalent of gas masks for use during gas attacks. So I think those looking after them did care for animals, and the very fact that you had veterinary corps testifies to that fact. With respect to memorializing animals, well, I don't have a hard view. You probably have seen the quite poignant memorial outside the Australian War Memorial in Canberra, which is a sort of a shattered piece of metal with a horse's head, which sort of says a lot, but I can leave it to your listeners to perhaps Google it and find a photograph and interpret it as they wish. Medals, yes. There are some famous examples, not so much in Australia, but certainly in the British Army and Navy, where animals were recognised. You're probably aware of something called the Dickin Medal, which is the animal equivalent of the VC. Various animals, horses, dogs, and even a cat have received that award over time since World War I. So I suppose, you know, from an historian's point of view, I think animals, when we talk about it, the discussion can be a bit over-sentimental, if you follow my drift. There are some quite saccharine commentary on animals in war, which just get away from the reason why animals were deployed in wartime settings in the first instance. But as I said, I won't buy into that. I think everyone is entitled to their own opinion.
It's such an interesting part of the story, isn't it? Because when I see these memorials going up, and including the ghastly one that's on the battlefield at Pozieres now, dedicated to animals, I understand there's a need. I won't quite say it's guilt, but I think there is a feeling amongst us these days when we look back and we say, well, the animals didn't have a choice. We just lumped them in there. Next thing, they were frightened. They were in a battlefield, a situation completely not of their making. And I think it says as much about us as it does about the animals that we feel this need to include them in the glory and to remember them. And I think it's a great sentiment. I think it's quite wonderful that people don't overlook the role of animals. But you're right, it's such a complicated mishmash of emotion and nostalgia and philosophy. And I find it quite fascinating. And obviously there's no dedicated answers to these questions, but I find it absolutely remarkable the way, particularly after all this time, we look back and we do want to remember animals that served on the battlefields.
Well, I'm glad you raised that point, Matt, because the statue in Pozieres is a very recent thing. So how long is it since the war is finished, if we look at 1918? Over 100 years. And veterans from that war, and even in the Second War, and those who were around in 1918, didn't feel the need to memorialise animals. So I think that's a point that we need to consider as well. It's quite a modern day thing with somehow feeling guilt or thinking about, you know, the poor animals, which is fine. That's a natural human emotion. But I come back to the point that as far as possible, animals were well treated during the war. So just to give you an example, the veterinary drug bill for just the Egyptian Expeditionary Force in the Middle East in 1917 alone was £100,000. Well, it's a staggering sum in those days. So people can't say that animals were ill-treated. Certainly they suffered, and sometimes when I read accounts of artillery going into action, particularly, you know, out of the Menin Gate and so forth, it almost brings tears to my eyes. But I think we have to look at these things in the cold light of day, and as you said, the issue of memorialization raises some interesting issues.
I think it's fascinating as well to cast even a little bit forward. I mean, this discussion is about the First World War, but just as an aside, noting well into the Second World War, particularly the Germans, were still so reliant on animals in the Second World War as well. That I heard a quote the other day that said the British Army was more mechanized in 1918 than the German Army was in 1940. And so throughout the Second World War as well, this reliance, particularly on horses, was just never-ending. And it's something that throughout the 20th century has just gone hand-in-hand. When men have gone off to fight, they've often taken animals with them. And it's, I think it's good that we remember after all this time, we remember that connection. We're free to interpret it as we like in terms of the philosophy and the morals of the situation. But I think it's just fascinating that whenever men have gone off to fight in the 20th century, they've taken their animals with them.
You're right. Germany, as you say, had a vast number of animals, but so too did the Soviet Union. And we forget that, I think. They had absolutely enormous numbers of horses and mules in their fight against Nazi Germany. Poland was the same. And if you look at the British Army in India, they still used horses too in areas that, interestingly, we're redeploying horses to in places like Afghanistan, where army veterinarians are also deployed, not just to give the locals a hand in terms of, supporting the civilians, but looking after army animals, which have been deployed to those theatres. And this is a current issue for us.
Well, Michael, it's just such a fascinating story, and we could go on and on about it because there's just so many layers to it, and it's such the connection we have with animals is such a part of being human that I think it's hard to escape these feelings when we talk about wartime. It's been really great. Thank you so much for coming and sharing your knowledge with us about this important topic.
A pleasure, Matt.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.